lovers, welcome back for another edition of Anatomy and Movie here at Popcorn Talk. That's right, grab your London Dry gin, make your martinis, because I've got a simple favor to ask you, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Is the suspense killing you? What is this favor, I might ask? Well, it's to enjoy our show. A very simple favor, unlike Blake Lively's simple favor in her movie called The Simple Favor. Of course, for those of you who are joining us for the very first time, welcome. If you're joining us for a second, third, or whatever time, welcome back. For those uninitiated, know that we are not a regular movie review show. We break down the plot, of course, but we also go into various details of behind-the-scenes production. And last but not least, we round out with box office numbers and so forth and speculate on those things. So it's information as well as opinion, if you'd like. Furthermore, because of that, it is very spoiler-filled, and especially with a movie like this, I would suggest to see the movie first before you have us ruin it. But then, of course, once you've seen it, you would get to enjoy us. Mm-hmm. See, it flips. And last but not least, if you want to follow along, we do have our rundown in the description box provided for you. You can get all the little nitty-gritty details so that way you can follow along. Now, allow me to introduce the rest of the panel, because I can't do it by myself. I wouldn't want to do it by myself. We have Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
And we have Dimitri Panos.
You might be able to do it by yourself, I'm sure.
I wouldn't want to.
And hello, movie fans. How's it going? How's it going, panel?
Going quite well. So now, the follow-up, we've introduced everybody, but now let's introduce your thoughts of the movie to the fans. Marissa, kick us off.
Yes. So I was very excited for this film when I first heard it was going to come out. Big fan of Blake Lively. Big fan of Anna Kendrick. Love Paul Feig. So I knew this movie was going to be awesome. I mean, when you have a trifecta of awesomeness, it's going to be great. And then I saw the promotions and the trailers for this. I was like, yeah, I'm already on board. Saw it for the first time, like, loved it. Loved it so much that I saw it the second time, 24 hours later. So I was like, yeah, this movie's great. I loved it. It was fun. It had a good balance of comedy, some dark moments too, but also a good thriller type of mystery storyline, which I'm a big fan of mystery as well. It had a lot of things and a lot of factors in it that I really enjoyed. So it's a very fun movie.
Marissa approves.
I did.
Dimitri.
So hard.
Yeah, no, you know, this is like the second mystery that we've covered within the past couple of weeks, the first one being Searching. This one, albeit based off of a book, it's still a mystery movie, and it was just diabolically fun. It was very Hitchcockian. It was nice to see Paul Feig sort of steps out of his wheelhouse of just doing female branded comedies. This movie is not without its humor. I found myself laughing to an extent where I almost believed that I was watching a comedy. And it is a comedy. It's a dark comedy in a sense. Mm-hmm. But it has a lot of Hitchcockian twists and turns and people in it. You know, the regular person trying to figure out this mystery and what's going on and who's cheating on who and what's happening. And I really truly believe, too, that part of why the movie succeeds, and I haven't read the book, but I believe why the movie succeeds is because it will throw various MacGuffins out there, or it will even have something in the movie where you figure it out almost instantly, but it doesn't really matter because you've got the rest of this movie happening and going on and various twists and turns that you don't figure out. So if it hands something to you on a platter that makes you feel smart as an audience member, you've got the rest of the movie to go through, and it really works. And I think a lot of it is because of the writing, but I think the performances. I think Blake Lively, I think this is one of her best movies. I really think she was fantastic. And the same as Anna Kendrick. I mean, Anna Kendrick has proven that she could play this kind of innocence and be a little snarky. and maybe in her way, tad sexy and all. And they both together are the full package. And I think the cast and I think the movie rests on their shoulders to carry it off, as well as Feig's, I think, great direction.
I would agree. I first saw the trailer and I kind of fell in love with the trailer. And then watching the movie, what's sort of fun about it, the first time, I, like Marissa, saw it twice within a 24-hour period. we saw it the second time together, not the first time. But you go through this experience where you're kind of wondering and you're trying to figure it out, and you don't know the tone quite yet because you're like, okay, there's a lot of humor with what Blake Lively's saying and kind of Anna Kendrick, but there's some deep, dark stuff. And eventually, once you figure out the balance and you at this point, if you haven't tuned out and you haven't seen the movie, major spoiler alert, Blake Lively lives. So as soon as that happens, like, oh, okay. And now, all of a sudden, I had the most fun once I knew that fact. Because until that point, I was like, is this going to be a ghost story? What the hell is that?
But that is sort of kind of given in the trailer. And unlike you, I really thought the marketing in this movie was awful. I really wasn't.
Well, it's hard to market a movie when you find out, you know, there's a big thriller behind it, and when the main character goes missing, we find out, oh, hey, she really isn't missing, quote-unquote, you can't market that, because that gives away the whole film.
It worked for the marketing in Gone Girl. I mean...
But also, that's not a comedy, either.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. I mean...
I don't want to get into the promotion too much quite yet, yeah, because there's a whole section that we get to talk about.
But
that.
I was just going on your point that, yes, I mean, I think that what you were saying about their performances and what it does and it's unlike anything that we've seen, which makes it fresh and makes it good. I think that tonally, you know, I think tonally it was right where it needed to be. It could have gone one way or the other, which wouldn't have made the movie as fun or as entertaining. And so, that's a tough balancing act to do. And the very beginning of the movie, you're right. Tonally, it was comedic just from banter and dialogue. And again, you can't carry it off with poor actors. And
absolutely. So
they did it great.
So let's take a quick step back, right? Because one of the interesting parts about this entire thing, and yes, it is based off of book, but at the time that this was all coming together, the book was not in circulation yet. It's not like it was a worldwide bestseller at that point. It's like, okay, you just like with Crazy Rich Asians, let's go, let's make this book into a movie. It was very much, we like the book, we'll option the rights, right, and we'll see what we get with both, essentially.
Yeah.
Turns out people really liked the book, and critics are really liking this. I don't want to cut too ahead, but I am sort of, as far as box office, I will say I'm disappointed that it's not hitting quite the way that I would have expected this to, because I think it is quite amazing. But you know, all the things that we've been hinting at as far as the balance of tone. Paul Feig was sort of approached by this project. And one of the things that he did like was the tone is very middle. It can, if he doesn't balance this right, it goes any which way. And so that's what...
And it fails.
It fails, yes.
You know, if that happens. Mm-hmm. Because then people don't really know what the hell they're watching. And I know with the audience that I watched it with, they were totally into it because you have that. But if you have a little bit of comedy and then it becomes serious and then dark and then twisty, then people don't know exactly what they're watching. That, I think, when we talk about it more, is the biggest problem they had with the marketing.
Yeah.
Is they didn't know what they were selling, but yet the movie knows exactly what it is and what it's paying homage to.
Well, hey, anytime you make Blake Lively sexy in a trailer, you've done your job. In my
How
eyes.
Hard can that be?
Listen.
But, like, I think they marketed her character well. Like, she is a mysterious woman. She's gorgeous, but you want to know more about her, but you really don't. And that's what we get in the trailer. And that's also what we learn throughout the film, that it's like, hey, we only see the surface level of this character, Emily, but who is she really? So I think they marketed the mysterious character aspect of, you know, movies pretty well.
Yeah, we'll get into it later.
Yeah.
Marissa, speak to the writing aspect of it, because especially, you know, going from book to movie, the third act was a complete shift.
Yeah, completely different. I personally have not read the book either, but Jessica Sharzer, who did the screenplay, she changed a lot of different plot points. And if you follow her on down, there's like a lot of the book differences that we list. But it a lot of the situations change within the characters, which changes just tonally. The book is way more darker than the film is, and the film has a more comedic type of ending and wrap out to the mystery compared to the book, where it's just straight up drama mystery.
Well, the ending, not only is it straight up drama mystery, spoiler alert for the book, Emily gets away with it.
Yeah.
She walks away with Nikki all happy as a clam.
Yeah, and Stephanie and Sean are the one who gets framed for murder.
How nice.
Yeah. Karma. Karma really does work.
But that one of the things, you know, a lot of people are citing a big difference between the book and the movie is the use of the narrators in different perspectives.
Right.
I thought, for my money's worth, this movie showcased everyone's kind of perspective quite well, even Stephanie's. And to be honest, I didn't, by the middle, I was like, is she lying?
Right. Yeah. And, like, I actually very much like the narrative, because apparently in the book, the narration is more for Stephanie and Sean. It splits between those two. And for a film, it makes more sense. Anna Kendrick is a bigger name, a more recognizable star. People can follow her character, and she's the one who's, like, unfolding everything between our eyes. And then when it shifts to the second, third act, when we get to Emily's story, it kind of shifts to her perspective and Blake Lively. Very well-known actor as well. So, like, it makes sense that for the film narration, it would go to two actors to follow that we're following.
Mm-hmm. And Dimitri, you had you thought similarly to mine?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely Stephanie's story. Like, we're seeing it a lot because it opens up with her. It opens up with her vlog. It ends with her vlog. So, and she is, as she aptly says in the movie, she is Nancy Drew. She's trying to put these pieces together as to what happened here. So I find that the narrative is going through her and through her Nancy Drewing it up. You know, she's finding out the keys to these mysteries, and so she's able to say, well, fact, I know that you burned the, you know, I know that you have a twin, and I know that you do this. And so that's where we get all this other great exposition, but it's the way that it's laid out, because it doesn't feel like exposition. Everything came very naturally, and the darkness of it all and the way that it twisted and the way that it built up mystery and intrigue. And again, I'm going, the thing that was simple, at least for me, was when we see the body being taken from the lake, first thing I thought was twin. It's a grand old magic act. That's what they
it's
do.
It's always the twin.
You know, it's a twin. Like, so we set this up as a twin. It ends up being a twin. But
triplet.
It's everything. And we just learn from there. So to me, it's a brilliant thing because, you know, whether you figure that out or not, I would say that a lot of people may have figured that out. But then it's figuring the rest of it out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, oh, all right, I got that. All right, well, who's cheating on who? And everybody's not a great character. But you still are rooting for Anna Kendrick in a way. And even to an extent, Blake Lively. Like,
Well, the reason why I start the shift was because, I don't know, maybe just part of me was like, people aren't this nice. People, and, you know, from that perspective, too, there's been enough movies that I've seen where the main character, you know, it's a divisive of movies. You only see what you're shown. And in this side of it, we're shown Anna Kendrick very specifically, Stephanie Smothers. And not only that, the information that she's saying usually comes from her vlog, which she has an ability to manipulate how she wishes. And so that's why I started questioning that aspect of it all.
True, but there was another great technique that was used in this as well. And it's usually a technique that's very cliche, and that is the flashback technique. But in here, it was used to contradict what the character was explaining. Oh, yeah, I had a husband, and he died in a car crash. But then we're showing a flashback with her current narration, and we, the audience, see, wait, no, that's not exactly what happened. Like, that's not... That looked like a suicide. Like, what's going on? And the same thing with Blake Lively's character as well. So I really like that juxtapositioning of a narrator telling you a story and then seeing what actually happened. And that was done really well.
It was. One of the biggest moments this is used is brother fucker.
Yeah.
What did you think of this scene?
Well, that's the whole telling of the story.
Right.
But I think it led to, it shows that we spent the first 20 minutes, we spent the first 20 minutes like understanding that Stephanie is like a seemingly perfect mom. She can do it all. She has no dark past. And then when we realize, we get more personal with her, she's not perfect either. So as twisted as her storyline is, you're like, okay, you have a dark side too. All right, that makes you more human, and that makes you more relatable. I, like, not to say I enjoyed it, but I like that they gave her a storyline that it played out to be a running joke at the end with the whole brother fucker over and over again, because it was said in so many different ways, it still made you laugh.
Yeah, from the first time it came up. And it was great because Lively's character knew what we had seen. So, obviously, the characters on screen don't get the benefit of a flashback, but she was still able to suss it out and go, you're a brother fucker. Brother fucker. And it was just
like
really fun. Yeah, it was a great scene. Now, again, we learn more of our characters, and every character here has they're not perfect people. So it makes me wonder about the rest of the people who are part of the PTA. But
Well, they were smoking weed, among other things. I have a prescription.
They're definitely not perfect.
So there's this noirish kind... Well, there's a noirish river running through this little quaint town in New England or Connecticut or whatever it was. But I think it adds to the flavor and fun of the movie.
It does. I was just more appalled. Like, it's one thing to be a brother fucker, but then she's a continued brother fucker. And that's where I was like, oh, boy, you are liking your brother way too much. I get he's your stepbrother, but maybe we should amend it to stepbrother fucker. But
brother fucker is more fun to say.
Brother fucker. And it was the way that it was the way that Blake Lively said it as well. That was, I mean, this is to, like, this is where the two of these actresses or these actors were brilliant. It was in the delivery of their lines. And they could be mean sarcastic, but it was sarcastic in, like, almost a playful sense with each other. And that's why I felt that their pairing was brilliant.
Yeah, and what I did appreciate was the fact, if you look at it from the objective viewpoint, they could have been friends, and they essentially were. All of these things ended up being very circumstantial. You know, she took out life insurance, not to try to get the life insurance, but just trying to actually do the right thing. It wasn't until the insertion of the twin, the sister, into her life that things went awry.
Right.
And as far as that, you know, I think that's a nice shift, because in the book, as I understand it, Emily specifically seeks out Stephanie for this quote-unquote role.
Right.
And I appreciate that in a different universe, Stephanie and Emily could have been friends.
Yeah, and like on some levels you can tell that they bonded as mothers. They bonded as people who don't truly understand them and what they do. On some levels you can understand why they would actually, you know, be genuine friends. But I always question, because then I see this running throughout television shows and movies and stuff, is that when you always pair two people together, so soon they already label themselves as best friends. I'm like, are you, though? But are you? They only knew each other for a handful of weeks, and they started calling each other best friends. So, like, it was hard to believe that they were best friends yet, but friends enough that you can follow them throughout the whole movie.
Well, I definitely, look, I think the movie has a task ahead of itself from a screenwriting perspective and from direction and acting, is that you've got the first act, you've got about 20 minutes to set these two characters up, and you have to make them likable, because our next act, when one goes missing and what happens, that's where the things begin to unravel. So I think they succeed. in bringing these two characters together, in having an audience like these characters, believe that these characters, that these opposites actually attracted, and that they begin to open up to one another, right? So that's the bonding. That's the friendship right there. So you do actually believe that there is something there. Even at the end, you still believe that there's something there. And that's important.
You know, when I look at it, Marissa, you are blessed with many best friends.
Am I? But
I think you are. You just don't know it. Stephanie and Emily literally had no friends. And so, therefore, by definition, when you only have one friend, they are your best friend. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the viewpoint I look at. Because Stephanie over and over said, like, it's so hard as a mom to be friends with other moms. You know, I don't get it.
Yeah.
That was a fun aspect.
But it's also punctuated by the, you know, by our other characters.
Darren,
right?
In particular?
Yeah, well, because they're always talking about them being together. So once they had that first play date with the children, then it became they saw each other very regularly, so much so that everybody else in the small town noticed it as well. And again, within the first 20 minutes, that all comes out, so that we believe that since this, they really have become close friends.
Yeah.
You know?
I want to cut to the quite opposite, literally the ending of the movie, because of something that you said, right? And their friendship, you buy into it. And the way things are kind of set up for the third act, we're heading into Stephanie and Emily are working together, and it looks like they're going to take down Sean. That does not happen. And I want to get – one of the things that's never revealed is what was the plan of Emily – what was Emily's plan to Stephanie for them to work together, and why did Stephanie not kind of adhere to it?
I think if you think about it just from like a humanistic character standpoint – like, Emily would work with anyone just to write her name off that, like, oh, hey, I got away with everything I just did. But once Stephanie did all the research and finding into Emily's life and realized, hey, this person's not a good person either, I'm going to work with her, think that we're going to do something else, but I'm also going to get her as well because she's also, at the end of the day, still a murderer. So it's like you can't let someone get away with murder, even though they're trying to get off on it.
Interesting.
So I think that was like Stephanie's mindset to why she was working with Emily, but also secretly working against Emily.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the love triangle. It's a crazy triangle with a little.
Or is
bit
it a
of,
square?
Or is it an obtuse triangle?
Kind of
the TA.
Okay, well, if you want to put in the TA as well.
But, I don't want to, no, but wait, I think just no. The way she comes in, hi, honey, or whatever she says.
Yeah,
so
handsome.
You have a guy who's betraying two women who are friends. And the way I viewed it was the initial thing was that Emily and her husband were going to try to get this money. And then things go awry. Husband sleeps with quote-unquote friend, but it seemed to be easier that if the two women get together, they can easily dispatch of the husband in a way where it doesn't include murder.
Because the husband always kills the wife.
Always. Yes.
So it makes more sense.
So it just seemed an easier way, but and that's where I believed. I said, oh, okay, I can buy them going off with the $4 million. Like, that would be, I'd be okay with that. Husband's in jail, right? Mm-hmm. They caught him, but no. Greed or something usually ends up taking over. And
well, by your definition, I just want to clarify. Are you saying that you thought Sean did have a hand in this the entire time, or no?
Yes. I think that something was, there was mention that this $4 million was going to set us free. So I believe that he had a hand in knowing what was going to happen, or like what, you know, in getting this money. But, you know, he and Stephanie had his tryst, but she would have been a patsy because she played it so innocently. But we know of her dark side and then her Nancy Drew qualities. You know, she was like, damn it. Once she found the sister or the twin, that was it. It was over.
I want to
see the thing with Sean is that I didn't think he fully was well aware of it when it first happened. I mean, we saw him grieve over the loss of Emily, and he was like legitimately grieving. So I was like, okay, he's innocent. But then when he found out that Emily's still alive and she visited him, then he's like, oh, this plan could work out if we just laid low. Eventually, we will get the money. Then he was on board. He was reluctantly on board. So I can't really fault him in that sense, because he didn't, like, concoct the plan. He just eventually went along with
it. Well, he didn't concoct it, but there is a line of dialogue in which Emily says, she's fucking this whole thing up for us because she found, you know, she's screwing up. She's taking our money. She's screwing it up because that's when the insurance got involved. Well, and that scene was really funny, by the way.
But you know, history... Again, how reliable any of this is debatable. But history sort of dictates that she brings him into situations he doesn't want to be a part of. She stole his mom's wedding, the ring, right? Mm-hmm. And she brings him into a very awkward situation, and he's just stuck. Whether he wants to participate or not, he's in it. He's kind of learned that just go along with it one way or the other. In this sense, I'm not saying it's the right thing, but... You know, you could see from his perspective, okay, if this is going to happen, at least we benefit with $4 million. Great.
He's easily manipulated by her, too, by her charms. He seems to be easily manipulated by almost anybody's charms, but hers in particular.
Well, I want to take a...
Is it love or is it lust? That's the thing.
I think it was lust, but there was some love there.
More lust.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's like a snake charmer.
She is. And you know what? But don't leave little innocent Stephanie out of this, because she has a habit of... Not only is she a brother fucker, pardon my French here, but she's a funeral fucker.
Yeah.
This is the second funeral that she had sex on pretty much the day of the funeral.
Well, at funerals, you're sad and you do stuff to make you feel better.
I'm just saying.
Not that I'm advocating it, but it happens.
Okay, but you know what I'm saying?
She's not perfect either.
But I'm saying, like, we were just putting this all on the husband as if he's done a horrible act. Right. It's Stephanie, too, that went along with it.
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah.
She's...
Look, they're all not perfect characters. And again, this is a very fine balancing act. Because characters could have been so vile that you would have hated them. But you really can't point to somebody and say that you hate them, or else this movie doesn't work. You have to you have to buy into the fact that there is some semblance of relationship there that means something. Because if they're so awful, then it's just a movie about bad people.
But that's also that's a good point, because that's why I ask: is it love or is it lust? I think Sean and Emily was more lust. Sean and Stephanie was more love, because we saw even at the beginning when Stephanie first met Sean, they immediately bonded over writing and literature and stuff. So, like, there are snippets about these two characters. You can believe that they could be actually a really good couple together. And so when Stephanie did get with Sean, like, yeah, I believe it. Like, they have better they have, like, some similarities in chemistry there. So you can understand. And then when you see Sean and Emily, you're like, why are they together? They really seemingly have nothing in common, therefore, right. I say this lust.
Yeah. Well, they really are kind of opposite sides of a coin, because Emily, she says what she wants, and it's kind of interesting. She never says the truth, but you tend to believe her a lot more. Whereas Stephanie looks so sweet and innocent, and it looks like she's being honest, yet she's half the time never really be that truthful. At the end of the day, so they're all just full of lies.
They are.
Deceitful.
They're very deceitful, but in this diabolically entertaining way for us, because number one, when you talk deceit, it's not just dialogue that's deceitful. To me, one of the biggest laughs for me, anyways, was when Emily comes home and she just rips off her mock turtleneck, so to speak. She rips off her mock collar, her mock cuffs. She's not even wearing a shirt. It's like, that's hysterical. Oh my god, because you look at it on screen, Ah, she looks great, but everything was tearaway. She was wearing a tearaway suit.
Well, it also kind of shows she's, like, again, surface level. It's all for appearance. It's all a facade.
It's all a facade.
It's literally symbolism that everything's fake in her life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something that was funny about Anna Kendrick, and I don't know exactly where to fit it in, so I'm going to shoehorn in here right now. One of the things she said, like, she did a lot of research with mommy vlogs and whatnot. Some she liked, some she was just horrified with. Mm-hmm. Now, she didn't state which ones horrified her, but I could probably imagine some. Not literally, but just the act of seeing some of these.
Right.
Right. Anna Kendrick also went on, I believe it was with Sean Martin and... Yeah, Steph Myers. Seth. God, I can't think of his name. Seth Myers late night talk show, and she was promoting this film. And she talked about the mommy vlogs, and she said that she was amazed that there are some that are, like, highly produced but get only little views, so you can tell it's just, like, for the look, right, for the aesthetic. And they really didn't put a lot of, like, actual content in. And then the others that are, like, webcam-only quality but has millions of views, because those were, like, more real, because they actually were giving real life situations and advice and stuff. So she like bent in death of, like, you know, there are some good mommy vlogs out there and some bad ones,
and the vlogs themselves in this movie also become a tool.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. So what starts off as being very innocent, right? Oh, I'm gonna show you how to make zucchini chocolate chip cookies, which that just sounds disgusting.
No, it sounds delicious.
If you say so.
I got robbed of a great zucchini recipe, personally.
Yeah, so.
What are you talking about? It sounds amazing.
If you say so. But then it becomes a means of communicating with Emily. and that I find to be very funny.
I love
you
the
know?
Comments that were following.
Oh,
along.
The comments are great.
Did you find her? Wishing you well.
Yeah.
Sending my thoughts.
Hope you're great. You're such a good friend.
Yeah, you're such a good friend. I hope you find her soon.
speaking of that, speaking of kind of the public image, one of the things that I've seen just kind of online of comments and whatnot is people being like, well, how did the sister find Emily? And I'm like, to me it's obvious. Let me see if you guys got the same thing I did. But when Sean posted, there was mention that Sean posted a family photo on Facebook,
right?
And then Emily asked him to take it down. Boom. That whatever small window of time, you know, call her like whatever you want, the evil Nancy Drew, but the twin found this and then was able to put two and two together.
Right.
Also, and if you think about it, Emily's job was very public. I mean, she worked in PR. She was the very definition of publicity. So, it was a different name, but everyone goes by different names now. I think with social media and the internet and working a high-end job, Emily was easier to find than her sister was.
I guess. But she, I don't know. Again, you have to kind of buy that she never had a photo taken, I guess, or something right. like that. But
and that was a great scene, too. Can you just take a picture of me?
Yeah.
I don't like. And again, like how she could change. And she goes, yep, you're so wrong. And then it comes up later. I'm so sorry about the picture. She goes, oh, get over it. Like, that only works when you have chemistry between two really good actors. I'd really like to see them in a movie together again.
Yeah, please.
Speaking of which, I thought that was one of the more funnier running gags was the I'm sorry. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not sorry.
Not sorry.
I'm working on it.
Gosh, that's a hard one.
Yeah, and it helps because it adds to the comedy and it adds the comedic beats throughout dramatic moments in the movie. And then especially with the whole, because we already jumped to it, the arrest at the end and she brings up the I'm sorry again, it still makes it funny.
Yeah, it makes it funny, but and it also just, to the contrast of these two people, oopsie jar, wait, oh, I'm sorry. No, the oopsie jar, and then at the end, the name of the book is called The Oopsie Jar.
And also the kids, I think, played a good job.
Yes.
Especially Emily's son, Nikki. He's quite the potty mouth too, and you can understand where he got that. But I thought he added a lot.
Yeah, I thought they were both really fun.
Yeah, and to that point, conversely, Stephanie's kid did say "oopsie jar" whenever
Nicky.
Oopsie jar.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a great moment. So let me ask you this: neither of you thought that perhaps this was going like a weird ghost story when he brought that up, that moment of like, "I saw Mom today."
Oh yeah, that was creepy because that was probably one of the first beats where the movie actually really goes dark. You're like, oh, creepy. And then I think the music changes too with the tone, and then you're like, that's not right. But that was also just as a general viewer, I was like, she's not dead. You can't kill Blake Lively this early in a movie, no.
Yeah, no, I didn't think it was a ghost. And plus, the trailer sort of sets up that this is going to be some semblance of Diabolique, the movie, and a Hitchcock thing. And they almost tip their hand that Blake Lively is not dead. Mm-hmm. So,
fair enough.
I didn't think it was going to go as a ghost story, but I liked how the characters in the movie almost treated it as such. To me, the great scene was when she emptied out that entire walk-in closet and then comes home from work or whatever. Everything's back to exactly where it was. That was a great. And then you just know. And then there was a note too, though, I believe. It was just very well done. Mm-hmm. I liked that scene.
I thought it was a good scene. I also liked when Stephanie got stuck in the black dress, which is the poster dress.
Right. Yeah, and the cop, the detective, that guy was funny.
He was great.
He was awesome.
Yeah, he was great.
And again,
breadcrumbs.
Paul, it's what he's able to do with women. Like outside of Ghostbusters, I'll look at it as a misstep. But here he's working, in a sense, he's working outside of his wheelhouse because he's not working with, say, Melissa McCarthy or these people from Saturday Night Live, comedians, so to speak, right? So we have Anna Kendrick and Blake Lively, and yet he's still able, with the right script, he's still able to craft as a director, you know, the right beats. Because we talk about comedy as being as beat-driven as a suspense movie, and here he gets to blend them both. And in this movie, I think it's really one of his best efforts film-wise because he really balanced it well. I found myself laughing far more than I anticipated in this movie. And it's almost like, what's the Hitchcock movie where they have the guy, people kill a person, they put him in a drawer and there's a party and people.
That's a lesser known movie that I'm not familiar with that one. Just
look it up.
Dial M for Murder?
Not like, Dial M for Murder. No. It's not Dial M for Murder.
I'm just going to go down
there. Pick a Hitchcock movie. Any movie.
I'll find it. You guys.
Strangers on a Train. I don't think it's that one.
Which still has a little bit of humor, but I'll find it. And all right. Yeah, I'll find it.
Let us know. Give us a little ding. You got it.
It's the Birds. We knew it.
It's the Birds. No. You're for the Birds.
Moving on.
All right. Anyway, so while Dimitri's looking that up,
there's rope.
I do want to talk about Henry Golding specifically because obviously he's right now as big as he can be. He's in Crazy Rich Asians, so much so that they ended up putting him on promotional posters because of that. Now, ironically, the reason why he's in this movie is quite literally because of Crazy Rich Asians.
Mm-hmm.
And well, you tell the story.
Yeah, so Paul Feig was, you know, looking for the character, the actor to play this character, and his good friend actually knew that Henry Golding was casted and was a big fan of the Crazy Rich Asians movie, right, and knew that this film was, you know, being filmed. And so Paul contacted the director of Crazy Rich Asians, be like, hey, is Henry Golden? Is he legit? Is he good? And the director was like, yeah, totally. He's great. He's a great actor. He's very directable. Got Paul in contact with Henry via Skype, and then Henry sent in a self-tape, and then that's how he got the part. So from one movie literally to the next.
Yeah, he is killing it.
He is.
Good for him.
He was really good in this too. I mean, again, I think everybody was really good. but he's very solid as that character, and is, when you break it down, he's pretty swarmy, right? But still, good performance. By the way, the two movies I'm sort of kind of combining are Rope and The Trouble with Harry. So those movies have like these comedic elements in a sense of, you know, it's people like Rope, they kill a person, and then people are coming over for a dinner party, and it's like, well, how are we hiding this person? Trouble with Harry is like, what do we do with this dead body? Mm-hmm. So that's where, and of course, Diabolique is referenced even in this movie. So, yeah. You know, it's this dark humor, and it's almost Paul Mazursky-esque too. So it like the dialogue was sharp, it's witty, it's unlike anything. That's what else makes it good. It seems fresh today. Yeah. Like, you know what, amongst...
Fresh as that martini.
As fresh, oh yeah, and boy did I want a martini. Boy did I want a martini, and I probably could have ordered one because I saw it at a dine-in theater. But yeah, mm-hmm. The way she made
missed
a martini. Oh, but I wanted Blake Lively to make it for me.
Yeah, don't, and actually, Blake Lively, because supposedly she doesn't really drink in real life, which is, you know, okay, good for you. And but she, because she's such a great actress and stuff, she was talking to Paul Feig. She's like, no, I need to really know how to make a legit martini and make it look like I know how to make them. So she practiced with Paul, and he's the one who actually introduced her to the London martini. Yeah. Like, huh, well, interesting.
She made them, he drank them.
That's right. Exactly. And she's also the type of person that would participate in the oopsie jar. As soon as they called cut, she would not swear it. They say, action, shit, fuck, motherfucker.
She's,
you know? So she went for it.
She did.
I'm really glad. All right, well, why don't we start shifting gears into the production aspects of things, which I know we've kind of been slightly talking about it, but now really zoning in on it. First off, it was filmed in Canada. So Canada for L.A. I guess it worked. And I really liked the way everything looked. I don't know. Part of it, I love Bible Camp.
Bible Camp was, yeah.
Looked great. Not that I want to go to that Bible Camp, but...
And again, the proprietors of Bible Camp were just hysterical. Mm-hmm. They looked really funny. So, yeah, Bible Camp was really cool. The entire thing, it looked as if it were a Connecticut or New England-ish kind of town. And again, from that kind of suburbia, it lends itself to having this dark thing. Well, we saw Suburbicon tried. See, Suburbicon tried to sort of kind of be like this. And it couldn't
pull
it off.
Too much was going on in Suburbicon.
Yeah.
But we definitely got the different aspects, because I feel like this movie was more about the characters than really anything. And we had to follow them. And the houses for each, you know, Emily's house and Stephanie's house completely showed the personalities as well. Emily's house was big and tall and lush and open spaces, which created a lot of voids. It was helpful for the shooting, for the cameras, so they actually had legit space to move around. And then Stephanie's house was brighter, colorful, more cheery, because she is a cheery person. So definitely different, and there were more like yellow tones in Stephanie's house. So it physically and visually gave you like a better understanding of these characters.
Yeah, I mean, the socks themselves.
Those blue socks.
From Target.
$10.
$10. $10 for $10. So also, though, we have to, like, the cinematography of this movie, I thought. Again, it lends to this very well, and John Schwartzman. The funny thing is that John Schwartzman and V were classmates and friends, and this is the first time they actually got to collaborate together. And Schwartzman latched on to movies like Blue Velvet as a guidepost. I'm glad he didn't go really too far down that rabbit hole, because this would have been a different movie. And it was brightly lit, poppy colors of that film, and he used that as his inspiration. And he didn't want to hide things in the shadows too much, and let's put it all out there in plain sight and let the audience figure out all the information, which is what this movie really does for us. So I found that to be interesting. They they had a brand new medium format Panavision DXL camera was used with Panavision Primo 70mm lens. And Schwartzman aimed for immediacy, dropping the audience right into Stephanie's confusion, which we get. And again, when you take the innocence of Stephanie and not knowing how dark she that character is going to get and can get and is, like, I find that very, I find that just fascinating. And looking at her vlogs, that's another thing, too, especially coming off of watching a movie Searching, right? Where this movie was based on social media vlogging, in a sense, right?
Yeah, that film.
And again, a fantastic mystery. This movie here, A Simple Favor, uses it. I mean, it's not, we're not seeing it all through social media. It's not dependent on it, but it plays a major character on it. The vlog is a tool. And it looked really, the way that it was shot and filmed, it looked as real as can be.
I like that it had the buffering, too.
Yes.
Like, yeah, that's real. That's real.
And she played with it, the fact of, you know, her performance of staying close, then zooming out. Here's what we're doing. We're making friendship bracelets and this and that.
And you almost feel as if you were a follower. Mm-hmm. Like, if you were watching her vlog on an extremely big screen.
Yeah. And what's so brilliant about it is the commentary on all of it, all the styles. You know, Darren in particular is kind of the voice of the cynic, if you will. You know, having seen murder cases, like, if they don't find the body in 72 hours, she's dead.
Right.
Or, yeah, you know, we started watching your vlog for fun, but you got some good stuff.
Yeah. Are those my brownies? They're brownies.
So I think what's great about it is using the elements, whether it be the cinematography, the sound, and all that, even the editing to a degree, and going one way with it, but then having this other aspect of it that contradicts what's being shown.
Right.
And I think that's where, again, the balancing act really...
Much like the narration.
Yes, indeed. So that's what I liked about it. Marissa, speak to the costumes, if you will.
Yeah, so the actual wardrobes is actually a pretty fascinating take. So we know that Stephanie's in the brighter, cheerful, fuzzy sweaters and stuff. So that was more to pop out her personality. But also Blake Lively's character, they based her actually on Paul Feig. Because Paul is actually known, every time he's directing, he's always in a suit. Always in like a three-piece suit. He's dressed to the nines because he's a very fashionable guy. And they wanted Emily to kind of mirror that look because it still showed that she's beautiful but also mysterious at the same time and powerful at the same time. So they gave her like suits to wear and she rocked them. And I mean, and it's, as I'm looking through the notes, we had... they modeled the suits all on the 30s and 40s, like Katharine Hepburn, Lauren Bacall, like powerful women. They're awesome.
And all of those, but they all were in noir movies. Yeah, noir as movies. Well.
Kelfis, which is Renee Elric Kelfis, who was the costume designer in the wardrobe. And it was her and Lively's idea to apply this to Emily's character.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty neat.
Yeah, and just going back to your thing regarding Paul Feig, it's more than fashionable. It is, it is the way directors used to show up when directing a movie. They would show up as if it were a professional. They were the leader of a company. Yeah. So it was never uncommon that people like Hitchcock and stuff would come in in suit and a tie. Sam Raimi. has
Nolan does it too.
Yeah. So they show up dressed properly because it's just a history of directing when you see that coming up. That's what they're comfortable in. It's an homage. That's how they were brought up. I think it's really cool that people
if you can do it. I look at movie directing as like almost going to war. Especially on the indie level. And so you know, for me, you need combat boots, not a suit. But that's my different viewpoint.
You know, it's a director. You know, it's just being the director. You have to look as if you can take charge, and it's paying homage to that tradition of what it is. I have to show to my crew, cast and crew, they can be comfortable, but I have to be the guy that leads them, and it's a way. You know, Steve Martin had always said, always look better than your audience. That's why he always showed up in a white suit and such. It's not a dissimilar takeaway from how directors used to dress and how some continue today when they show up on set. But you're right. Some go for more comfort because you're right. I'm in a war. I have to think quick.
Like, who wants to wear a suit in 100-degree temperature?
Right.
A lot of people wouldn't. But the suits, they wanted to make Emily look powerful and intimidating.
And she did.
And yeah, she definitely did. But also to show that the character is like, she literally hides herself also in her clothing.
Yeah. And if I want to.
It was a symbolic to that.
Yeah. And I want to point out to this poster right here, because to me, anyways, the way I looked at it was the paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm.
It was Blake Lively dressing as maybe Anna Kendrick would in
For those that are listening on audio, it's the more standard poster, but it's the dress that Emily wears at the end.
It's the bluish, 50-ish kind of dress that she's wearing that you would think Stephanie would wear.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's wearing that black dress she gets stuck in. So
interesting. Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. I liked it.
All right.
Yeah, I liked it too.
So, all right. Let's round out with box office numbers, because this is where it kind of deteriorates. Now, on the Rotten Tomatoes side of things, 83%. Not too bad. Not, you know, I would have expected perhaps a little higher. Cinema score is B+. But worldwide box office as of today, let's round up. Let's be generous. $25 million. It came in third behind The Nun and The Predator. I'm very disappointed by this fact.
Yeah, I'm disappointed too, but I'm also not surprised, because Nun is horror. Horror always does well. Predator is action, gory. Action generally does well too. And when you mix those together, this is definitely counter-programming to those two movies that came out.
It is, but I go back to the marketing. The marketing just, they did not know what, the marketers didn't know what they had as a movie. As regard, like, they got really good reviews, right? A B+, I believe, on Cinema Score.
Mm-hmm.
So audiences that went liked it to a very good extent. But it, again, the marketing didn't tell you what this movie is. Is it a comedy? Is it a mystery? What am I watching here? They said, this is Paul Feig, when you're usually used to watching him do these broad comedies like Bridesmaids or Spy.
I think one trailer said the darker side of Paul Feig.
Yeah, and it was a mixed bag. I like the print, but the print doesn't really sell. Like, the print ads were fine. It doesn't sell what the movie is. They didn't know what they had, and it is too bad. It's unfortunate. The audience I saw with really enjoyed it. It got some, like, decent applause at the end. People were engaged watching this movie. It is bad because it's too bad because it is fresh. It's something different, and it pays wonderful homage to certain French films and Hitchcock, and it's got it all that people really would get into.
No.
It's too bad.
I think the thing is, they were also banking on the star fact and the stardom of Blake Lively and Anna Kendrick. Together, if you actually follow them, because I do, on Twitter and social, like, any social media platforms, together they have like over 50 million, like anywhere from 30 to 50 million. They have a large, devoted audience. So, like, I think they were also selling it just on the fact of these two are together. They're in a movie. We don't know what the movie's about, but watch it because those two are in it.
Well,
that's what they got me on.
To sort of put to wrap it up in this perspective, I mean, I can't say with 100% certainty, but Paul Feig really wanted it to not be advertised as a comedy. Now, I don't know how much of a hand he had as far as the direction. I can't entirely say. You are correct. Blake Lively did do a very interesting thing where she deleted pretty much her entire Instagram account, followed only Emily's And in that sense, now there's great articles out there. She's like, I didn't actually delete my account. Like, all the photos are there. Yeah. Blah blah blah.
She hid them.
With Instagrams. And finally, you know, it's interesting as far as the Instagram accounts, because they put out interesting kind of promos of it's not what you think and whatnot. So there's that. And at the, you know, I wish the. I thought from a marketing perspective, I was satisfied. It doesn't seem like you guys are satisfied. But anyway, there you have it. Thank you guys, as always. We appreciate you. Later today, we will be doing The Predator. And then next week, we will be doing White Boy Rick and The House with the Wall and the Clock and the something
the
or other.
The House with the Clock and its walls.
Okay, that
just
one.
Just be very careful in how you say it. It's not something you want to say 10 times fast, because it'll sound like a movie that we don't really cover here.
House Fair with enough. The Clock and its walls.
At Serafini TV for Marissa.
That's right.
At DMovies1701 for Dimitri.
Yes.
I'm at Phil Svitek. We'll see you next time.
Producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network. We would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.